Hi, volleyball fans, and welcome back to Volley Talk, the podcast created for volleyball lovers who want to dig deep into what is going on in NCAA and international volleyball. I'm your host, Sarah Pavin. I'm an Olympian, beach volleyball world champion, former Nebraska Cornhusker, and longtime pro, both indoor and on the beach.
And I'm Adam Schultz, former indoor player, international volleyball coach, and resident stat guy.
It was a massive week in NCAA volleyball. We had the Power Four Conference Champions crowned, star senior athletes were drafted, and the final push to the Final Four in Louisville has begun. There were so many exciting matches, and I hope that you guys were able to catch at least a couple of them, because I know that we had a fantastic Thanksgiving break, hanging out with friends, watching a lot of volleyball, talking about how we think the rest of the season will play out. It was awesome.
I'm pretty sure Wednesday wasn't a holiday, but I was hunkered down on the couch. We had matches start at 9 o'clock, then noon, and all throughout the day. I think I had my computer with me so I could respond to emails, but I'm pretty sure I just watched volleyball.
We're in California, so we got the full day, and it was perfect timing.
That's one of the best things about being on the West Coast is sports start first thing in the morning.
I unfortunately had a lot of things going on Wednesday, but every time that I passed by Adam, he was engaged in volleyball. So I had to catch up a little bit later, but I was very jealous. But all that being said, there is a lot to cover this week, and we are very, very excited. So let's get started. First things first, Monday, the PVF draft happened. We watched it, we followed it. There's a lot of cool draft decisions that were made. We are going to talk about the draft in depth next week. We've got a full slate here, everybody, for this episode, but we wanted to let everybody know we did follow along. We do know what happened, but we're going to talk about the PVF draft next episode. We also had the NCAA selection show. Lots to talk about there. I know everybody is very excited about tournament time. We're going to talk about the selection show a little bit later in the show today.
Looking at the matches that happened, Florida had a rough week. They lost both their matches to South Carolina in 5 and to Georgia in 4. We saw no Fitzpatrick and no Stuckey against South Carolina, which is interesting. I don't know if they're injured and they're hoping they're going to be back for the tournament, but Fitzpatrick didn't play either match. Stuckey did play against Georgia, but not against South Carolina. It wasn't a great day for the outside Martin hitters. Isabel went 103 on 29 sets, and Kennedy went 163 on 49 sets. As a team, they hit negative 087 in the fifth set, losing 15-13. But get this, South Carolina missed 30 serves in that match. So there's, like, Florida should have been able to pull that one out, and they just missed and didn't play very well at all. And then against Georgia, they started really well, so they had a good rebound, but their hitting percentage got worse and worse as the match went on. They hit 441 in the first set.
Wow.
I know, it was great. And then in the second set, 241. Third set, 129. And 094 in the fourth set, losing 25-13. It was crazy to see how they just declined as the match went on.
And a rapid decline at that. That's crazy.
Isabel Martin struggled against Georgia as well. She hit 036 on 21 attempts. You had Amaya Thomas had a good game against Georgia, hitting 583 on 12 sets. And Kennedy Martin did step it up. She hit 412 on 51 sets. So she looks like she's ready to go for the tournament. But Isabel Martin's going to have to figure it out because they're going to need her to score points. They should not have lost those two matches going into the tournament.
Absolutely not. Last week, we didn't even talk about the matches that Florida had because naively, I thought they were pretty straightforward. But maybe, you know, Isabel Martin got that call from the PVF. She got drafted. She was feeling good and just fell off a cliff.
I don't know, but they're going to have to figure it out because losing those two matches going into the tournament is not where you want to be.
Absolutely not. But Kennedy Martin has been solid all season. So I'm glad that she had one match that is herself. She does carry a heavy load for Florida. She can't be expected to be perfect every single match. We've talked about this with other players in the past, but Kennedy Martin hitting 100 or less than 200 is uncharacteristic, to say the least.
We also had Kansas lose to BYU in four. Now, it was clear that Kansas prepared for Claire Little because they kept her to 173 on 52 swings, which when you plan for somebody and you can hold them to that, kudos, you executed your game plan.
Well, Claire Little does get set a lot for BYU. She does score a lot of points, but I will say her hitting percentage is not great. So, like, hitting under 200 is not unheard of for Claire Little, I would say.
But in the past, we've seen teams be able to do that to her and the supporting cast not step up and they don't win. But in this case, BYU's other hitters all had great days. Their middles, Kirsty Strong, went 545 on 22 sets. Brielle Kemavor went 478 on 23 swings, which is great for both of their middles. And then Ellie Mortensen also hit 478 on 23 swings. So they all got a decent share of balls and all played really well. And that was the difference in this match in my mind. It's funny, we look at Kansas again and their middles didn't play super well. Ana Banjo hit 111 on 28 sets. Reese Patak only got set 12 times. Yet again, Kansas doesn't win the middle battle. Kansas doesn't win the game.
I would even go so far as to say if Ana Banjo doesn't show up, Kansas doesn't win the game. Because we have seen multiple scenarios here with Kansas and their middles. We've seen both of them play great. We've seen both of them have very poor stats. We've seen Patak have bad stats and Ana Banjo play great, and then we've seen the reverse, as is the case here. I think it all depends on Ana Banjo now, not even just the middles, because when Ana Banjo has played really well, had great numbers, and Patak hasn't, the team has still been fine and still won. But we see when it's reversed, not the case.
Ana Banjo does get set more, so that makes sense. Caroline Bien also did not play super well in that match, going 156 on 32 sets. So she's going to need to play a little bit better as well. We've seen in those losses, she can't score, and she's going to have to figure out a way to be more productive.
But I'm guessing El Nadi was solid.
El Nadi was the same. I think she was close to 300. I don't have the numbers in front of me, but she's always reliable, and she cleans up the garbage.
As we talked about at the end of last episode, the ACC was going to be wild this week, and it delivered.
It did not disappoint.
Oh, baby. So Stanford, let's start with them. They had a reverse sweep of Georgia Tech, and then they beat Louisville 3-1. So this was a huge week for them because they were hovering around the 3-4 mark with SMU before this week, but defeating Louisville put them in second in the ACC. And I think that this week in general was a huge momentum builder for them heading into the postseason.
And we're not going to talk about them this week, but we did talk about them last week. Georgia Tech had two bad losses last week, and we were concerned about them. But I do want to give them a shout out. They played really well. They didn't win, but they played two really good teams, and there was some real fight, and they played well. Even though they didn't win, I think those matches served them well going into the tournament. So I just wanted to acknowledge that because we were rough on them last week.
Well, they had Stanford. I'm pretty sure. Was it in set three or four?
They had a swing for the match.
Cammie Miner went back to serve. Stanford was down, what, like 24-22?
I think so.
And they managed to win 26-24. Like, Georgia Tech had no business losing that match. Honestly, they were a different team compared to the week before. They were refusing to let the ball hit the ground. It was great to see that change.
It was really good to see them bounce back, and I think they played well, even if they didn't win. That was good on them to have a really good response.
And took Pitt 17-15 in the fifth.
Like, yeah, no.
They pushed two great teams.
I think other than winning, it couldn't have gone better for them. As great of a week as it was for Stanford, pulling out that win in five, Louisville had a rough week. They lost to both Pitt and Stanford in four.
So we watched both of Stanford's matches this week. We watched both of Louisville's matches this week. Not a great way to go into the tournament. I know they were really tough matchups. We're not trying to take anything away from that in that situation, but you do not want to end conference play like that.
Well, I thought in the Louisville-Stanford match, the difference to me was for Louisville, you had Anna DeBeer and Charity Looper get 40 and 46 sets each. They were much higher than the rest of the team. Anna DeBeer played well, going 350 on her swings. Charity Looper only hit 239.
Which isn't terrible.
It's not terrible, but then if you look at the flip side on Stanford, they also had two players that received the majority of the sets. You had Elia Rubin hit 326 on 46 sets, and Jordan Harvey go 302 on 43. So to me, that's the difference, because all of those sets were incredibly close.
I mean, Stanford and Louisville played on Saturday, which was after the Pitt-Louisville game. Louisville just seemed a little deflated. They didn't seem to have, you know, the same energy, the same fight, the same swagger as they did in the Pitt match. Like, completely understandable. They did not pull off the ACC championship. They knew, you know, their fate was kind of sealed. But I do have to say, building off of what you said, Anna DeBeer, when she was in the back row, Louisville was giving up runs of points. And you notice that particularly in set three. Stanford was up 2-0. It was near the end of the set there. Louisville had a decent lead.
Yep.
Like, and then before you know it, it's 24-all or something. It was like closer than it should have been at the end of that match. And Anna DeBeer was in the back row.
Now, do you think that's all Anna DeBeer being in the back row? Or do you think it has to do with who was setting at those times as well?
We can talk about that situation a little later. But once Anna DeBeer got to the front row at that point, she scored like 4 points by herself.
I think
basically to win that set.
Yeah, it was incredible. She swung. I think she got a solo block and
two kills.
Yeah, she was really, really good.
I will also say I love Cammy Miner. I love her. The woman can deliver the ball. And she is offensive at the perfect time. She blocks well. She serves well. She's like a leader. You can tell that everybody kind of turns to her. She's like a calm presence on the court. Like, for me, that is what you want out of a setter.
Well, the other thing I really appreciated about watching her play, Louisville's a very good blocking team. And unless you were really paying attention, she was able to move the ball along the net for her hitters incredibly well. For her middles, you saw Sammy Francis hitting out at the pin, hitting halfway in between, hitting close behind, making life difficult for the blockers to line up. And you saw the same thing on the outside pin, running inside, catching the blockers a little far, moving the ball all the way to the pin to open up the line swing. She was able to make life for the very good Louisville blockers tough, and they had to pay attention, and she caught them out of position a few times.
They were out of position frequently, and I think if you weren't watching, you might not have noticed, but it was very well thought out. It was very well planned, and Cammy Miner is good enough that there is no way she's missing that many sets.
100%.
It was completely deliberate, and she, the way that they were moving their hitters around, it was a thing to see.
I'm very curious if any of the teams that play Louisville in the tournament are going to pick up on that and be able to use it against them.
Continuing on with the exciting matches that happened this week, SMU swept Florida State and then, you know, followed that up with a loss to NC State to finish ACC play because, you know, why not? Purdue also beat Oregon in five in what was another incredibly tight match.
And then we saw Kentucky beat my still-standing dark horse team in Missouri in four, and they hung on to the title.
Kentucky is solo SEC champs, yes.
We've talked about this a little bit, but Pitt was also tested this week, and I think that's good for them. They went four with Louisville, who's obviously a great team, and five with Georgia Tech. We alluded to this. Georgia Tech played teams tough this week. So Pitt actually lost their first set since October 27 against Louisville and then went on to drop two to Georgia Tech. So a little bit of adversity is never a bad thing heading into the tournament. Sharpens the focus, makes you aware that you're not infallible and that you have to show up and play really well. And so we'll see what happens to them. Understandable that after you beat Louisville, you maybe let your foot off the gas a little bit against Georgia Tech, but they're ready to go.
I mean, the Pitt-Louisville match was the one to decide things. And as we mentioned earlier, that win over Louisville earned Pitt the outright ACC championship. We will be talking about that match more in depth a little later on. And the other match that we're going to talk about later on as well was Penn State versus Nebraska. Penn State handed Nebraska their first Big Ten loss of the season, winning 3-1 and claiming a share of the Big Ten title in the process. So Penn State upset a lot of people this week, namely Cornhusker fans.
I'm not going to lie, I didn't see that upset coming, and it was a game to watch.
Not sure that this coming week is going to be as exciting as what we just witnessed, but we were very lucky to have this much excitement over Thanksgiving break. Our first feature match this week is Pitt versus Louisville, the showdown that was to determine the ACC champion. What were your, you know, key takeaways from watching that match?
Well, Pitt obviously wanted to get Babcock going early, and she was lights out in the first set. She came to make a point. Babcock had 7 kills in the first set. Pitt as a team had 5 blocks and sided out at roughly 80% in that set. Those numbers are absolutely staggering. They had a message to send. I loved Louisville's pushback in the second set. Pitt struggled to pass in that set. Louisville's block was really disciplined, forced some hitting errors, gave themselves a chance to get back into the match. It was a good pushback to see in that second set, and then after that, it was just a dogfight.
I really appreciated how many balls Rachel Fairbanks set to Babcock right off the bat.
You would as a right side?
No, and I like that's the thing, is I really do appreciate that because as a player, I had a very similar role to Babcock, and I can't tell you, like, if you are a traditional point-scoring right side, you need to establish a rhythm early and as fast as possible. So I really loved, I want to say, I'm making this up, but it seemed like, you know, 3 out of the first 4 balls of the match were set to Babcock, and then she established her rhythm and was able to carry that on. As a right side, it is really tough when your setter's kind of distributing it to everybody. And then when you need points, they start setting you. It's really tough. So I really appreciated that. And Olivia Babcock actually tied her career high in kills against Louisville with 23.
So I thought Pitt served really well. They did a good job of pushing Louisville back. Louisville had a lot of passes around the 10-foot line in that first set. I thought the setter for Louisville, Cabello, did a really good job of getting her feet to the ball, getting square in that tough situation, and giving both her middles, which probably shouldn't have been an option with passes like that, and the left side, hittable balls. Louisville did not make her life easy, and I thought her specifically did a really good job at that.
I was shocked at how bad Louisville's passing was in the first set.
Agreed.
I don't even think there were very few passes in front of the 10-foot line, but that was all predicated on Pitt serving. You didn't see the Louisville passers pass anything in their, you know, wheelhouse. They were moving back on every single pass. And as a server, that's what you want. You don't want players to just be able to be static. You want them to either have to come forward or drive back. And I thought that was the difference for me in the first.
I agree. I thought that Pitt's serving strategy overall was really good. I did think that Louisville did a good job of adjusting in the second. It looked like their passers took a step back. They pushed the ball tighter in the second set, which I'm sure was a focus from the coaching staff. And they ratcheted up their serving pressure in the second set. Yeah. And the first two sets to me kind of flipped because Pitt struggled to pass in the second set, and then Louisville's block was able to take over.
100%. And you saw Pitt was advancing the ball better in the second than Louisville did in the first, but the passes were really low and fast. So you saw Fairbanks having to almost go to her knees to try to throw sets up, and that completely destroyed Babcock's rhythm too, because she was making errors and Louisville's blockers were getting her. Like, she got blocked a few times in that second set. And again, as you were saying, it was a flip-flop situation of the serve receive. So I think once the first two sets kind of ironed themselves out from a serve and pass perspective, then we saw kind of like the true meat of the game.
If you look at the hitting numbers for the match, it was really interesting. The first set was very close percentage-wise, and that set was obviously 25-23 in Pitt's favor. But after that, the teams that won the sets hit over 400. So you had Pitt hitting 424 and 417 in the third and fourth sets, and Louisville hit 481 in the second set to win. So the ability to pass and be efficient was crucial in this match.
It was interesting to see. It was like Pitt tested DeBeer on serve receive early. She did not pass well. She finally sort of got her footing under her in set two. So then they switched up their strategy and started serving short, which also was effective for a while. Then Louisville figured it out. And then they finished off the game and kind of saw it through serving Charity Looper.
We've seen Nebraska implement similar serving strategies, and I think that this is really important going into the tournament, is that it's going to come down to adjustments. And this is something I was thinking about as I watched matches this week, was at the beginning of the season, teams are focused on building their own skill. But as we've gone and watched big matches in the last couple of weeks, you're starting to see game plans come into place. You're starting to see more adjustments. Teams are refined. I thought the Wisconsin game against Nebraska was a prime example of that. And so these big hitters who get a ton of balls, I think life is going to become increasingly difficult for them in the tournament, because teams are now prepared. They're focused on game plan and executing that, and things are firing on all cylinders. So it's going to be really interesting to see the response of some of these hitters.
Well, and it's also like nobody knows if they're going to play tomorrow. So teams are putting all of their resources, all of their brain power, all of their time into you, because you are what is in front of them right now. It's not like, okay, well, we have like for sure have two matches this week, so let's like spend time on both. It's like, no, if we lose this match, we are not playing anymore. So let's go all in. I want to kind of talk about Louisville in general here, a couple things. First, we said it last time we covered Louisville, Elena Scott's setting, outstanding.
Totally agree.
One of the best setting liberos out there, I would say.
I'm a huge fan.
Number two, this might be a controversial statement. Let me know what you think about this. Louisville runs a 6-2. Cabello is a much, much better setter than Glock. For me, watching the game, I don't even notice when Glock is on the court. And when they're giving up runs of points, don't get me wrong, there could be a correlation with DeBeer being in the back row, like call it what you will. But I think as a setter, you need to have a certain amount of presence. And I feel that from Cabello. I do not notice Glock's presence on the court at all.
I've actually wondered why they're running a 6-2 versus a 5-1. Because I think that some of the players who are struggling could benefit from finding some consistency from one setter. And my thought is, I'm wondering if this is purely strategic or if they're trying to get players playing time so that they don't lose them to the transfer portal or keep their younger players so that they can transition the team. I would be very curious to get a frank answer on, is this the best method for winning now, or are you doing this looking ahead to the future?
I mean, Reese Robbins had a great week overall, and she put up great numbers against Pitt.
And she hit 533 on 15 swings.
Maldonado Diaz, she's steady. She's solid. She did not play well in one of the matches, at least this week.
Against Pitt, she hit 095, so she was not particularly efficient in this match.
See, so it's tricky. I mean, I personally think that they would be better off running Cabello in a 5-1, but what do I know? And she's a freshman. That's the crazy thing. It's like, she is running a much better offense. She seems confident. She's not even small. Like, she can't put up a block. They do keep her in. They kept her into block for a couple rotations against Pitt. She is capable.
I mean, I think Danny's a very good coach, and she's obviously running a really good program. I just haven't been able to figure out what the factors are that go into that decision.
And then the last thing I want to kind of key in on Louisville is the number of X plays they run. They are running a 6-2, so they always have three hitters in the front row. They run X plays with both the right and left sides frequently. So they will have the middle run a slide and the right side come around and hit like a meter ball, as we call it in Canada. And then on the left, they'll run a 31 with the middle and have the left side come in. I don't know. It's very 80s to me. I want to understand what they think the benefit is, because, for example, when you're taking the middle on the slide, the right side coming around, sure, the left side has to come over and focus on the slide. But if you have a right side blocker who is competent at all, you're still going to have a double block on the meter ball in the middle. Like, I'm confused.
I mean, I can see a little bit of motion from the right side in the middle being something you can use to kind of catch blockers off guard. The one that really confuses me is when they bring the left side in to run a quick and they push the middle into a B or a shoot set, because now you're clumping all the blockers in one place and you don't even really have an outlet.
Your right side and your middle just don't have to move. Those blockers can just stand there and block both players at once.
I can see the right side. You know, maybe you catch some players off guard. Maybe they're not used to it. That would be a very situational thing for me in terms of when you use it. They seem to use it a lot, but I'd be curious what the actual efficiency is and if they're tracking that as to, again, like you said, it's not necessarily a bad idea. It just doesn't pass the eye test for me.
Yeah, watching it, I just... Unless you think like Cressy is that good at hitting a slide, that would be my only consideration. But the crazy thing is they set the right side on the meter ball more often than they set the slide. So yeah. If Cressy's that good at the slide that you want to get her the ball, set it to her. Use the right side coming around as a decoy and set her. But like, you're setting a high ball in the middle more often than not.
The only thing that would make sense to me is if you're going to use a back row attack on top of that. So you're creating motion in the front row and then running the back row over top. But I don't, if memory serves, I don't remember seeing that very often, if at all.
The only way the back row attack would be effective is if they move it, because with a hitter coming around, the approach angle and the timing of the set would get in the way of a pipe. So you either need to move your position six pipe hitter in between the gaps. So either run them, you know, in zone five or run them on the C ball in between the slide in the middle. But like, running a straight pipe would not be effective. That is something about Louisville that like really bothers me, because like, I can usually figure out the purpose behind certain decisions, but that one, it's got me stumped.
It'll be interesting to see if they use that in the tournament or if they were just running different things during the regular season to hide some of the player tendencies.
The final thing is, for me, I think Anna DeBeer is a very solid player. She's multifaceted. She plays well on both sides of the ball. She is always good for a critical error, though. Whether from the service line, taking an ace, whatever. What is that face for?
You and I have different opinions on the beer.
What? Okay, I kind of like it.
The only thing I will say, DeBeers tends to miss serves after timeouts or freezes in play where there's a challenge or something happens. I will give you that. But we just talked about her scoring 4 points in a row to win a set. I'm a big DeBeer fan. I think she's clutch. I think even though she's not raw on the court and she looks stone-faced all the time, she's a leader for that team. They all look to her.
Whoa. First of all, I think you missed the part where I said she's a very good player on both sides of the ball. And let me tell you, I am the last person who will ever criticize a player for not smiling. When I played pro in Korea, you want to know what my nickname was?
It wasn't Smiley.
It was not Smiley. It was the Ice Princess. You know why? Because your girl had an angry face most of the time. I will never criticize an athlete for being serious or intense or whatever. That is not my problem with her. She makes errors at bad. We saw it against Stanford. She got aced at the end of set three. Granted, she made up for it with those points at the end, but she got aced at a very bad point. And we see her miss a ton of serves at critical times.
I will give you the serving one. I think she's more clutch than you give her credit for. The one thing, when she makes errors, normally they're terminal, which sometimes can kill your team. But I think she's incredibly important to that team. The one last thing I wanted to talk about in this match, and we alluded to it in terms of teams game planning for players. I think a really good example of this is if you look at Stafford for Pitt and you look at Charity Looper for Louisville. So in that match, Stafford started hitting the ball cross court predominantly and was very effective. Louisville adjusted their block defense, started giving her the line, and do you know what Stafford did? She detonated balls down the line.
It was insane.
Right? That to me is, she has the ability to see what's going on, to see what they're giving her, and to take it and be effective. Charity Looper, however, likes to hit the ball cross court and seems to have the mindset of cross, cross, or more cross.
Yeah, she just hits straight pretty much.
And that is the difference between being able to figure out what a team is doing to you and make an adjustment and just doing what you're comfortable doing. And that's going to be a huge difference in the tournament, I think.
But I like, not every player is capable of coming to those in-game realizations themselves. So in cases like that where the player is not aware or maybe doesn't have that vision or volleyball IQ, like, the coaches need to step in.
Agreed.
And be like, hey, this is how the defense is playing you now. Let's try this. But we saw it against Pitt and Stanford. Looper hit the same swing almost every time if she wasn't tipping. I also, this is like not volleyball related, but I am obsessed with Babcock, Stafford, and Jones's handshake. When the three of them are in the front row, please take note if and when you watch Pitt play next. When those three are in that rotation, when Pitt is serving and they're all in the front row together, they have got the cutest handshake and they do it every single time. And I love it.
If we're not talking about volleyball, Louisville needs to burn the white and black uniforms.
Hate
or the
those.
Mostly white uniforms. They're awful. I love the red. Go with the red.
Go with the red. Go with the black. I was also not a fan of the white ones. As a summary, you get a completely connected, on the same page, go to battle for each other feeling from Pitt. And I honestly think at this level, that type of attitude goes so far.
I mean, I said it before, and I'll use it here as well. Pitt was just better.
Well, yeah. I mean, you mentioned, like, looking at the stats, across the board, every category of stats was pretty equal. But if you really look at it, if you are a stats person and you really want to focus on the stats, the difference to me is that Pitt is getting huge hitting numbers from their outside hitters, and Louisville is not. The best, like, hitting numbers were coming from Louisville's middles, which is great. You want your middles to be hitting well. But when you're getting those numbers from your outsides who are getting 60% of your sets, that is what a good team needs.
I thought that the match was really entertaining. It was fun to watch. I think that it puts Pitt in a really good place going into the tournament. They are firing on all cylinders. Louisville has had to battle. I'm curious to see what their response is going to be, but that was a great game, very entertaining.
Our next feature match was the one to determine the Big Ten champion, and we are talking about none other than Nebraska versus Penn State. Adam, what were your thoughts?
I very much dislike being wrong.
Oh my gosh, me too. The conviction I had. that Nebraska was going to take this in four or three?
I just didn't see them kind of, I don't want to say they fell apart, but not execute that late in the season. I thought with a match that was going to give them the title outright, that they would have come out with a little more, I don't know, I think emotion is the wrong word, but with a little more kind of fight and grind. And I didn't think that their outside hitters as a core played well enough to win.
I've got a couple thoughts, just building off of what you just said.
You always have a lot of thoughts when it comes to Nebraska, so
I'll
strap on here and have at it.
No, I connected to what you're saying. I'm going to kind of speak to the outside hitter situation first. All season, Nebraska has, you know, been getting pretty consistent performance from Harper Murray. They've been getting pretty consistent performance from Merritt Beeson. And that other left side position has kind of been the hole or the wild card. And so Taylor Landfair has come in and kind of held it steady for the last several weeks. But for all intents and purposes, Nebraska has come to kind of depend on or rely on performance from one outside, from their middle, from their right side. This game, however, Beeson kind of disappeared and the second left side kind of disappeared. So having both of those kind of positions underproduce at the same time was a killer to them.
There were a couple storylines here that I thought were interesting. One is I thought Nebraska did a really good job at putting Mrzyk in trouble from an offensive standpoint. And that, I mean, that was obviously going to be the game plan. In general, when you play Penn State, if you can control Mrzyk, you have a good chance at winning the game. However, they forgot that a grudge can really come back and bite you in the butt. Penn State has two players that transferred from Nebraska that are not usually required to carry a heavy load in order for the team to have success. And let me tell you that Juravicius was on a mission in this match. And there's no better way to stick it to a team that wasn't going to give you a chance than to go out and be a stud. And I can't say it any other way. This girl hit 414 on 29 swings and, quite frankly, was the reason they won. And at the same time, Maggie Mendelson also had probably the game of her season, and the two of them just refused to let Nebraska beat them. I mean, I had my popcorn out. I thought it was great.
Okay, yes. My second statement, you were saying, like, you expected more fight, more attitude, more conviction from Nebraska's side. There was no shortage of conviction and attitude on Penn State's side, and I loved it. Okay, let me tell you. Rebecca Alec, she's got swagger. She's got attitude. That's normal. Andy Jackson, don't kid yourself. The girl has got attitude as well. And I am here for it. I love a stuff and stare. I love a backwards walk. Like, look over your shoulder. Do it all. I'm obsessed with it. Those two, they were themselves. They did the same thing. Nebraska operated like themselves. Penn State did not like those stare downs. They did not like the backwards glances. They took it personally, and you saw Juravicius giving it to them. It was coming back. And Nebraska, I'm sorry, I'm a fighter. Okay, so if a team is like operating like that, oh baby, you are lighting a fire under my butt and I'm getting in your face. Nebraska didn't really change. The two who like usually bring the attitude continued. But, like, you didn't see anybody else step up and be like, what did you say? Say it again.
And that's kind of been the knock on Nebraska for me all season long. You don't have an outside who really takes over matches. They pass so well that they're always in good positions to score. And it's not that they don't care, but I haven't seen them need to ratchet up against the team. And when they got some pushback, they didn't respond well. in my opinion.
And your middles, the two people who bring it, they're only playing half the match. I would have loved to see somebody kind of like not get into it. And I know like maybe that is a huge attractive quality that a lot of people see in Nebraska is their kind of business as usual mentality. But like you're fighting for a Big Ten championship here. Like, are you going to let a team take that from you? Because for like Nebraska, it was in their hands. You know what I mean? And like when push came to shove, you didn't see that attitude of like, this is mine. This is ours. And that was kind of disappointing to me. You can make up any storyline you want about Juravicius and Mendelsohn and their feelings about Nebraska. There may or may not be something there. We don't know.
But it sure looked like there was.
Oh, man. To see how bad those two girls were fighting and that they had that chip on their shoulders, you have to respect it.
So there are two things that worry me about Nebraska going into the tournament. The first one is this pushback and this attitude, because the stakes are only going to get higher. And when I look at those outside hitters, I've seen it from Beeson more than any of the other two or three left sides. She will sometimes, you can see, want the ball and be willing to put the team on her back and take some swings. But which of their outsides is going to do that when the pressure mounts, when they're playing for a spot in the Final Four, when they're playing for the championship? They haven't had to do that because they're so good as a team. But when the chips are down, who's going to respond and who's going to carry the team? So I would have that question in the back of my mind after watching that game.
I 100% agree with you, but it also makes me, are they allowed? You know, the team culture in recent years has been such that it's, we are balanced. We don't have one star. And so do they have the freedom to be like, get me the ball right now? I am going to take over. Again, we don't know. But I think they have been trained to just understand that we are a balanced team. We are all, you know, doing our jobs. We all fulfill a role. Is one person going to be able to like kind of look at Riley and be like, get me the ball right now?
I'm telling you right now, they will not cruise through the tournament without at least one of their outside hitters having to take over a match. It's not going to happen. And I thought Penn State's strategy of serving Harper Murray was very effective, something we haven't seen a lot of teams try and do. And there were some passing issues. And when there are passing issues, you can't run your two middles as effectively, and you need an outside to step up. Nebraska's superpower is their ability to control the ball and have four hitting options on every play. It's incredible to watch. But what happens if that breaks down? What are you going to do? There are some interesting questions they're going to have to answer, because I think that's going to happen at least in one match in the tournament.
To be fair, we've watched many Nebraska matches, but we haven't watched all of them.
Fair.
By any means. We have watched like the big ones. And in those matches, we have not seen teams kind of try to bury Harper Murray on serve reception. We have seen teams, the matches that we have watched, and I understand we have not seen all of them, so take this for what it is. We have seen teams be overly concerned with the middles, and we have seen that play out kind of by serving to position one. I also was, especially after, in my opinion, Penn State's miss in the serving strategy department against Wisconsin, it was really great to see them go after Harper Murray as relentlessly as they did, because earlier in the season, when we saw them play, she was not passing well. And do we need to mention the final from last year where she got served off of the court by Texas? Harper Murray's a good player. She is not a great passer. And I think that that was evident against Penn State. We talked about Juravicius and Mendelsohn playing really well. Nebraska set out to neutralize Jess Merzick.
Mission accomplished.
Mission accomplished. She hit zero. What they did not prepare for, and it makes sense. Juravicius has not been, she has played, but she has not put up crazy numbers. Nobody could have predicted her to go off the way she did. And here is my opinion about how all of that played out. Nebraska was very focused on Merzick, stopped her. Okay, when Juravicius was getting set, Nebraska, as they should, were leaving the line open on attacks that were coming from the right side of the court, whether it be a slide, whether it be Juravicius on the right side. Why? Because you've got one of the best liberos in the country digging down the line. Let her dig the ball. That totally makes sense. I think a big reason for Juravicius having so much success and gaining confidence as the match went on is in set one in particular, the majority of the attacks that were coming from the right side of the court from Penn State were down the line, and Lexi Rodriguez was not picking up the ball. If you're hitting down the line at arguably the best defender, the best libero in the country, and she is not able to handle that, that increases your confidence, and it makes you more willing to take risks, to take big swings that you maybe wouldn't if balls had come up. And I turned to Adam, I remember, early in the match saying, Rodriguez needs to pick up these swings or this is not going to go well for them. And she just did not deliver. She was digging the cross court swings very well, but down the line, not enough.
So I have a question for you. So you've neutralized their best player according to your game plan. Everything's going well. And all of a sudden you have somebody have the match of their life, which Juravicius did. You see that she's hitting exactly where you want her to, but your best libero in the NCAA, and she is, I think she's very good, but she's not executing on that night. And we very rarely think about defensive players not executing. Do you just leave it like they did and say, you know what, she's going to come out of it, she's going to dig this ball? Or do you make an adjustment? Because I kept waiting for Nebraska to take the line away from Juravicius and make her swing angle. And they never did. And I'm curious because as I started to think about other matches I've watched Nebraska play, Rodriguez passes incredibly well and she reads cross-court attacks better than probably any other libero in the NCAA. I haven't seen her need to dig that many balls down the line. She digs the tips really well, but not the hard driven. And I'm wondering if that look and just having a fraction less time affected her ability to do that. And should Nebraska have made an adjustment?
Simple answer, yes. The thing is I truly believe that a lot of coaches tell their right sides or players hitting on the right side of the court not to challenge Rodriguez. I truly believe that that is a conversation before games. So she hasn't had to be tested. But what you saw is Penn State was like, I don't care. I'm hitting what is available. And it worked. And then tips down the line started working because Rodriguez, for the first time, is sitting there dug in because she's being challenged. And then she wasn't able to react to the tips down the line as effectively. What Nebraska should have done is shut down the line completely because their middles were blocking machines that game. Andy Jackson and Rebecca Alec were blocking incredibly well. And so what you want to do is because of that, they are going to, you want to funnel the attacks to them. They're having a great night. Let them shut her down in the angle. At least try it. But we did talk about this too. Juravicius was unconscious.
Absolutely. It may not have made a difference.
It may not have made a difference. There were balls that like she probably should have been blocked on that rattled around and were weird. Like nothing was going wrong for her.
Correct.
And sometimes, you know, do I think she made like incredible swings for the whole match? No. She was fearless in set one and was able to carry that momentum forward. But then she had a lot of rattlers and weird stuff go on. Like, it happens. But I think if they had, like, shut it down early, she would not have had the match she did.
And if she doesn't play that way, Nebraska wins that game.
She was the only Penn State attacker that, like, really did anything, because Jess Merzick was, quite frankly, a non-factor.
Yeah,
which, in another controversial opinion, really makes me wonder about her potential as a pro. We saw her completely disappear against Wisconsin. We saw her completely get shut down by Nebraska. What do you think is going to happen at the professional level, where now you've got the best of the best who are able to execute game plans every night, who are all big, who are all skilled? Just something to think about. Kind of switching gears, continuing on to Penn State. I thought Jillian Grimes, the libero, played very well.
She was noticeable in that match for me, and that's not something I usually say about Penn State. I thought next to Jarvicious, she was their second most important player.
And while I think she started slow, Izzy Stark really got better as the match progressed. You saw she set some unhittable balls, in my opinion, in the first set, which is kind of uncharacteristic from her. You don't often see that, but
she looked nervous to me.
Oh, understandably. It's her first time, you know, playing Nebraska. You're playing to give your team a shot at the Big Ten championship. Like, it's not a small moment. So she definitely took a bit of time to kind of ease into the match, but she got better and better, and I thought she did some outstanding things.
Kudos to her. I mean, she still set Jess Merzick a ton of times. Merzick got 52 sets. But she went to Jarvicious, who had the hot hand. And to me, that's a feel thing that is important to have as a setter. Because I'm going to tell you right now, their game plan, their offensive game plan, was not, we're going to set Jarvicious a lot. That was not in the plan going in. And for her to be able to feel that out and pay attention to it and put her in a spot to score, I thought showed really good composure as the match went on.
And honestly, outperformed Bergen Riley in every category. More assists, more blocks, more dig. Like,
I mean, we've been an Izzy Stark fan on this podcast since we started. I think she's incredible, and I think she's going to lead the NCAA for the next 4 years as the best setter. So Lanfair didn't have the best of nights. She hit 077 on 26 balls, and we saw Lindsey Krause come in for her later on in the match.
Only set 4, I believe.
You expected more, to be honest. I thought she was awful.
Why did they set her so much? She got 17 sets in one set.
And hit negative 118.
Like, you almost got as many sets as Lanfair did in 3 sets. My question is, okay, I understand subbing her out. They needed to make a sub either with Beeson or Lanfair, because both of them were having a rough time. But you're coming in, and not only are you getting set almost every ball, you're hitting worse than the two that were already struggling. Like, why did they not put Lanfair back in?
I mean, maybe you're giving her a chance. You're going to give her the set, see what happens, try and make sure she's got some feel going into the tournament. But this is what we talked about this earlier. This is what worries me about the Nebraska outside hitting core. You don't have somebody who, when things break down, can hit those out-of-system balls as far as we've seen so far. And then you bring your next player in off the bench who performs that way. I'm worried it's a get it done by committee or not get it done at all.
I mean, yeah, sometimes you do need one player to step up.
And that's not to say that those players aren't capable of it, but it'll just be something to pay attention to in the tournament, I think.
Well, Nebraska's going to have to hope that their ball control is on point. Because this game, honestly, was the first time that I've seen them this season where I was like, wow, their passing is not okay. And wow, they're not digging this ball. Like, Nebraska's bread and butter, aside from being well-balanced, is their serve-receive and defense. And during that match, I had questions about both aspects. So,
and I mean, let's not overreact. They went 18-1 on the season. They've beaten a lot of good teams. Like, this formula has definitely worked for them all season long. But it will be interesting to see what other teams take from watching this match when they play against them, and if we see similar strategies implemented and how Nebraska responds.
Oh, I still think that Pitt and Nebraska are the two best teams in the country. Don't take these statements as like the sky is falling. No, I think Nebraska and Pitt are the best teams. It just makes you take note because this was the first match of the season where it was like something was on the line. You know, it was either we lose this and we have to share the title or we win it and we take it all. It was the first this is it match of the season. And so it'll be interesting to see because now it's all important do or die matches. It'll be interesting to see like, you know, a regional final perhaps or a final four match or the final. Like it's something tangible on the line now. So I'm curious to see if this was just kind of a blip on the radar or if it's, you know, something is there. I think it'll be interesting to see how both of these teams perform in the tournament. Both are going in as number one seeds in their respective regionals. So, you know, Nebraska having this loss, maybe some renewed motivation, some taking a look at some new things. Penn State seeing that they can win without an outstanding performance from their star player. Like, I think some positives can be taken from both sides. So I'm curious to see how this affects the team's mentality and how they perform going into the tournament. Selection Sunday just happened. The bracket has just been released.
Oh, baby.
Wow. Okay. It literally just got released. So we're going to have to talk about this as we kind of take a look here. But just off the top, Volley Talk has two brackets open for our podcast community. So I've included the links in the show notes below this episode if you're listening to it on a podcast platform or if you're watching on YouTube. It is in the description box below. One of them is through ESPN and it requires a My Disney account to log in. So if you have ESPN, ESPN Plus, Hulu, etc., use that login information. And there are unlimited number of members that can sign up for that one. And then on the second bracket, it doesn't require registration or anything, no email, no account, but it is limited to 50 members. So the first 50 people who sign up for that bracket, I'm sorry, that's the limit. So yes, be sure, check out the links that I've included in the show notes below to sign up and join us because we are submitting our own brackets to take everybody on. Okay, let's take a look here, everybody.
This was interesting. And I think next week we'll dive in a little bit more and do some analysis on certain matchups, who's coming, what's come out of week one. But for now, we just kind of want to highlight some of the collision courses that we're looking forward to off an initial look at the draw.
This is going to be a bumpy road. Okay, so in the top half of the bracket, which is the one seed, is Pitt. I mean, no surprises there. And it looks like Penn State has moved up to the three seed overall with that win over Nebraska. Also makes sense. Nebraska is the two seed and Louisville's the four seed. So,
I mean, I don't think anything about that is particularly surprising. Creighton had a really good record, but their strength of schedule just wasn't good enough to push them into the top four.
Totally. We've also got, it looks like if the bracket holds, two ACC teams will play in the national semifinal, two Big Ten teams will play in the national semifinal. They've also got like the similar conferences potentially knocking each other out in the regionals. So if you go back to episode one, back when we were baby podcasters, the question we asked was who is going to get SMU? Looks like it's Pitt, everybody. The only team to have defeated Pitt this season, that is the potential matchup to go to the Final Four, which I think is like kind of evil.
And you can't tell me that somebody wasn't looking at that going, we'll just slot them there and we'll see what happens.
Oh my gosh, that is so evil.
Just for the record, Pitt's not going to lose that match, I don't think.
Pitt is not losing that match. Are you kidding me? So, okay, looking at this layout, some things that jump out to me. first weekend, round two, potential Missouri-SMU matchup.
I actually think that is going to be a really good match. I think SMU doesn't really have a stud, and neither does Missouri. So there is the potential for that to be a which players step up, which team serves the best. I think that's a really interesting matchup.
In that same kind of regional, we've got a potential first weekend of Kentucky versus Minnesota.
I haven't watched Kentucky play, but Minnesota's one of those teams where if they decide they're going to be good and everything clicks, you don't want to see them. Kentucky's got to be at least somewhat unhappy about that, I think.
Well, I think there is no escaping here. It used to be like first and second rounds were like kind of a yawn for like seeded teams. That is not the case anymore, okay?
Are you kidding? Kentucky, Minnesota in the first round?
No, second round.
Well, sorry, I said round, I meant first weekend.
Yeah, and then potential Oregon TCU first weekend, Oklahoma Pitt. I'm thinking Pitt, you know, I don't want to jinx anybody, any top seeds. I don't love underdog wins. I'm just going to put that out there. I like when the good teams, the teams who are supposed to win, win. That's just my thing.
Shocker.
I think Pitt will move through round one and two pretty straightforward, but they're in that top left part. Week one could be interesting. Then we go to Pitt, the Penn State side. We've got a Florida State-Creighton potential matchup there. In week one, we've got a Texas-USC matchup that could come to heads.
And Texas, for me, is a huge wild card because you know that they have the potential and the firepower to be really good, even though they haven't really found a stride this season, in my opinion. So that'll be a team that I'm paying attention to and I'm watching.
And, like, it is not lost on me that they put Texas in Creighton's side of the bracket. It's kind of like Creighton is the wild card high seed here. Like, their conference isn't as strong as some of the other ones. They've been ranked very high all season. But then Texas has won the last two national championships. So, like, you know what? Let's just let them face off because we don't know what's going to happen.
How good are you? That's the question for this.
How good are you, Creighton, basically?
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Are you really there? Are you for real? And can you beat a team that has proven to be a winner but isn't currently playing super well?
I think Utah will move through the first weekend. They potentially will match up with Marquette in round two, but I think Utah will have that under wraps. And then Penn State potentially facing North Carolina. I think Penn State will be okay. As we move down to the Louisville side of the bracket, Louisville, I think, first and second round, probably the most straightforward of any.
The BYU-Purdue matchup is an interesting one for me.
BYU-Purdue could be interesting. We've got similar structure depending on their left sides here. Both teams similar off. I think Purdue will take that. I think their middles are better. But then looking up, we've got Kansas, Florida as a potential, which given the size of Kansas's left sides, I think Kennedy Martin could do some serious damage there.
Yeah, that's a matchup for Florida. I think if you can neutralize Kansas's middles, you're looking at going, okay, we have a shot here.
I'm curious about that one.
That one for me is tough to predict.
And then I think, you know, Stanford will potentially see LMU. LMU's got Washington in the first round, though, so don't sleep on that. But I think if everything holds, I think Stanford will be totally fine. This quadrant seems like Pitt's quadrant seems substantially more difficult. Like Pitt's regional grouping seems so much more difficult than this one. I don't know.
Well, I think in Pitt, bracket, you have a couple teams that are kind of wild card-ish. Like SMU has been good all year. They've beaten good teams, but you don't look at them and think they're a powerhouse. You have Minnesota in that one, who is also really good athletically. They could have a match where everything clicks. And the other one, you know, Stanford's bracket, you know which teams, you know what you're going to expect. There's a little more consistency there, I think.
And then we come to Nebraska's side. Their regional looks like they could face off with Miami in round two.
Who are the ranked team killers.
Who are also wild cards.
Yeah.
Like, those girls, their passing and ball control is, like, really all over the place, but they can hit an out-of-system ball. But I do think, like, Nebraska's discipline will win out.
Well, I think the strength of Nebraska's serving is really going to put them out of system, I think. And they're a disciplined blocking team. So as much as Miami is a bit of a wild card, I think they actually play into Nebraska's strengths.
The Dayton-Baylor, that one's weird to me. Dayton, again, kind of similar to Creighton, but in a even weaker conference, in my opinion. I think Baylor could potentially cause some trouble there. I don't want to say for sure, but then we've got Arizona State and Texas A&M that could potentially match up in the second round.
I think Arizona State's playing pretty well.
Yeah. Wisconsin, Georgia Tech, a potential second round. That's a tough second round matchup, but I think Wisconsin's size will cause Georgia Tech a lot of problems.
I agree.
But looking even forward to the regional, a potential Nebraska-Wisconsin.
Shocker.
I honestly thought that Wisconsin would be put in.
With Penn State,
but then that would mean that they would have had to put Creighton with Nebraska.
Well, I also think,
like, do you want both Nebraska schools? I feel like they did that for public interest more than anything.
Well, I also think that Penn State winning moved the needle with where they would go.
Yeah. I don't want to be like a big baby here, but I think Pitt and Nebraska have the toughest, like, regionals for sure. You have the two teams that have performed the best. Like, let's make it as hard as possible on you. Like, I don't know. I'm not loving this. I think Penn State and Louisville, well, Penn State more than anybody has the most direct route to the Final Four, depending on which Texas team shows up.
I honestly don't mind them having a tougher route. I think it sharpens focus going into the tournament. You know you can't take any games off. I don't think it's a bad thing, to be honest.
We literally just got access to this, like, right before we started this segment.
So this is off the cuff.
Yeah, no preparation. We have not prepared anything for this. Just on this first glance, any surprises, any head scratchers?
I think it's more competitive in the first rounds than I was thinking it was going to be. I haven't watched a bunch of these teams play, so I'm going to need to dig into this a little bit and take a look at it. But I think the Nebraska-Wisconsin quarterfinal is going to be really interesting. I think that's potentially the toughest route in.
Well, Louisville-Stanford is tough.
That's true.
I think Louisville-Stanford and Nebraska-Wisconsin are the two toughest, should everything hold true, the two toughest regional finals. I don't think SMU-Pitt is going to be the game that, you know.
There's going to be extra motivation there for Pitt to kind of put a stamp on that. And let's be honest, if Pitt is playing well, I don't think SMU matches their firepower.
I agree with you. Yeah, some of these potential second round matches, I am surprised at how difficult they are. And then other ones are just, they seem so much more straightforward. I can imagine it's very challenging to come up with this bracket, but, like, based on the layout, it is very clear that they were like, let's put all the same conference teams in the same regionals. So if everything holds true, then we'll have an ACC Big Ten final. Like, that's what I'm taking from this.
I've been hearing a lot of rumblings that the ACC is the new top conference. So we'll find out where that all lies after the tournament.
Regardless, this is very exciting, very interesting. First and second round matches starting this week. We will dive into our bracket picks and kind of go more in depth into what our predictions are next episode. But be sure to sign up for one or both of the brackets that we have set up for the Volley Talk community. Be sure to get your picks in by Thursday, because the submission deadline, it closes right before the matches start on Thursday. So head to the links in the show notes below, fill out your bracket so we can keep track. And that's also why we can't give away our secrets on this episode today, because we are competing against you guys and against each other. So you will hear what our picks were next episode. This is going to be really exciting. That concludes this week's episode of Volley Talk. There's always something shaking in the volleyball world, and we hope you enjoyed this little fix. Be sure to follow the show so you don't miss any updates, and we'd be so grateful if you'd leave us a 5-star review. You can find us on Instagram at volleytalk_podcast. If you have a topic that you want us to discuss, be sure to let us know by reaching out to us on Instagram or at info@sarahpavin.com. Thanks so much for joining us, and we'll be back next week.